again from all of us at the HBS podcast. I am Samara Greenwood, and today I am talking with Dr. Felon Modi, historian of medicine and metascience researcher, on the topic of biography as a research method in history of science. For non-historians, scientific biography is likely thought of as a straightforward retelling of a celebrated individual's life history, like Albert Einstein or Marie Curie. However, historians are finding that biography as a research tool in better understanding our past is better put to a broader range of valuable uses. For example, Felon has used group biographies in her own research to investigate the role of migrant and refugee doctors in shaping regional medicine in Australia during the early 20th century. Felon draws our attention to the range of ways biography can be used as a valuable research tool, especially in recovering important stories of women, Indigenous people, and non-elites in the history of science. Hi, Felon. Welcome to the HBS podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So could you tell us how you came to history and philosophy of science?
I actually think it's probably a fairly standard story in that I was doing a Bachelor of Science, majoring in genetics, and I'd picked genetics because that was when the Human Genome Project was in the news, and it seemed like genetics and biotechnology was going to be the future of science and scientific inquiry. And I thought, yeah, that's what I'm going to do. And in the process of studying genetics, I found increasingly that actually the questions I was interested in fell into this kind of weird and wonderful area of study I had never heard about called history and philosophy of science, which I was studying at the University of Melbourne, and realised actually that I was quite lucky because we're one of the few universities in the world that actually have an HPS department. And it was through that that I discovered biotechnology in society, which covered a lot of really interesting and contemporary topics in science and technology studies, and didn't look back.
And so what are your research areas now?
I am a historian of medicine, particularly 20th century medicine, and I'm broadly interested in the structures and practice, particularly of primary healthcare in Australia. But in the last sort of 4 or 5 years, I've also found a sort of secondary interest, if you like, that combines my HBS training with what is an emerging area of science called meta-research or meta-science, where we're actually looking at the ways in which we can improve the rigor or the integrity of scientific practice in ways that are done in partnership with or in collaboration with scientists as well.
So you're a historian of medicine primarily. Yeah. What did you find so interesting about research in that area in particular?
I'm an unusual historian of medicine in that I'm not interested in 18th or 17th century medicine. I'm actually interested in the ways in which you can understand really mundane topics like medical manpower and how global historical events can disrupt the flows, including of medical professionals, and what the implications are, for example, for patient or citizen experiences of healthcare. So to give you an example, World War II is considered to be one of the biggest disruptors of the flow of medical professionals owing to events that happened in Central and Continental Europe. And actually that had huge ramifications in terms of the ways in which medical knowledge flowed, the ways in which hospitals and GP clinics were staffed. You know, Australia was one of the recipients of a lot of migrant doctors or refugee doctors, and that's actually had sort of flow-on effects or, you know, legacies, including in the way in which we structure healthcare. And for example, if you want to understand Australia's position as the second or the third most prolific hirer of migrant doctor labour even today, the roots of those understandings can be found in the post-World War II era.
So turning to our central topic,
sure.
What is something about history of science you believe would be of interest to a broader audience?
Yeah, actually, I'm going to answer this in a bit of a cheeky way in that I think broader audiences are already interested in this because it's actually possibly one of the most marketed areas of science history, and that's biography. It sort of has this really strange position because biographies, broadly construed, not just in science or medical history, has a huge market. So as a result, in academic circles, people who use more broader biographical methods, they tend to occupy a really divisive place in their respective communities, if you like. So biography it has a really controversial place as an academic methodology. And so I think it would be really interesting to a broader audience to sort of understand some of that, but also to understand the really unique ways that biography or biographical methods can be used in order to really gain unique and different insights into sort of any given research topic because of the nature of the method, and also because, particularly as you want to diversify your viewpoints, it gives you an opportunity to go beyond the very thing that has both vilified biography, but also is its greatest strength, which is it gives you perspectives that are often hidden or invisible or marginal in kind of traditional historical records. So let me give you an example of that. Women, Indigenous peoples, non-elites, they are the hardest to find in preserved, written, archival records, right? Mm. And so biographical methods, including sort of collective biographical methods, are often ways in which to recover insights into, for example, lived experiences of people who have traditionally not been documented because they weren't considered to be important, or have been documented but in really kind of piecemeal ways, right? So you've got to be inventive or read an archive across the grain in order to tease those fragments of the past and put them together to form a picture of whatever it is that you're researching. If you compare it to why people are weary of biography, and that's because, particularly in the history of science, there were sort of these competing traditions of writing biographies of great white men or a great idea that was often had by a great white man, right? And so there was a real turn within our discipline of not wanting to do that, but that came sort of at the expense of the potential of biography as an academic kind of research tool. You can find this kind of long conversation about why it's bad and why it's good to be really kind of simplistic about it.
Absolutely. And so you're saying that by reframing biography in this certain way, by drawing out ways that it can be used to an advantage in academia, yep, we can sort of better see how it can be used.
Yeah, that's right. In preparation for this, I was sort of thinking about influential scholars who've had similar ideas. And the one that I sort of pulled out was Michael Polanyi, who in quite a long time ago said in 1962 that historians ought to pay attention to ordinary workers in the scientific community. And he sort of said, and I'll quote here, "The example of great scientists like Einstein is the light which guides all workers in science, and we must guard against being blinded by it." Really, it's about the different ways in which you can think about and understand any given historical episode. And biography is a really powerful tool if you want to explore a concept or a movement or whatever it is in a way that sort of captures the everyday or the ordinary. And that's been used to really great effect in a lot of different ways outside of what's traditionally pops in your head when you think about biography. And, you know, you think, oh, Einstein or Feynman or whoever it is. There's actually a lot of really interesting work that's been done that uses biography, but in ways that are sort of not well understood.
Mm. Have you used it in your own research?
I have, and I suppose that's why I'm sort of waxing lyrical about it. Of course, I have a bias. So I used biography in kind of that collective sense. So I was interested in the careers and the lived experiences of migrant doctors who came to Australia between kind of pre and post-World War II. And that actually gave me some really fascinating insights into, for example, the ways in which, you know, bias and structural discrimination was embedded within kind of legislative and regulatory frameworks. And that's not a common way that you might think about what biography might reveal. Mm. But that's exactly the sort of thing that it does reveal, because you take a group of people who, at an individual level, might not be a significant enough actor to warrant their own kind of, you know, sweeping biographical study. But when you put them together actually allows you to say something really significant and new about a point in time in a way that hasn't been understood before.
And is perhaps more relatable too than a whole lot of statistics?
Well, absolutely. I think that necessarily, particularly if you are doing 20th or 21st century historical actors, you have the opportunity to interview them. It brings in the component of oral history as well. And again, that's really important, particularly if you're working with, for example, in Indigenous communities where you have a tradition of oral retelling, and that's the core of how memories are passed on across generations. But oral histories also allow voices that haven't been documented to be brought into relief, and women are a great example of that. Particularly, for example, professional women, while they were practicing, would have been very reticent and careful in how and what documented evidence they left behind. But as a retired older person might actually be more comfortable and more willing to kind of provide some of that insight on reflection in a way that you will only capture if you actually go out and talk to them.
Absolutely. It's nowhere else in the record other than in those memories.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so, that's the other thing about biography is that it tends to like give you the ability to really pull evidence from a lot of different places. So you're not just tying yourself to a particular set of archival records, or you're not tying yourself to reading or interpreting those records in kind of traditional ways. It allows you a level of flexibility. But I will owe that that flexibility has also led itself to dubious practices, right? So that's why it kind of remains controversial, like people who use biography to kind of develop these psychobiographies or retrospectively analyze kind of key historical figures to make kind of sweeping claims.
And when you were practicing it yourself, were there certain things that you kept to the front of your mind about being careful not to do?
That's a really good question. I think I wanted to champion the voices of people who I felt had been marginalized in the historical record. And so one of the things that I was really careful not to do was to try and have this really binary view of the people I was researching as either victims stripped of agency or pioneers or heroes who fought against a thing and won. That was really important to do because if I did that, I would be falling into the types of practices that people are rightfully wary of when you deploy biography. And so I had to, keep reminding myself that people who were discriminated against, they had agency. And in similar ways, people who might have been thought of as pioneers or heroes, actually they were flawed. And it was important to kind of center that. And that was sort of my guiding principle, if you like.
And so why do you feel this topic in particular would be of interest to a broad audience? You've mentioned some things, but are there other things you can think about?
There are, and I might do that kind of in combination with some examples, just to kind of make concrete what I guess I've been talking about in the abstract. And so I've talked about the ways in which it gives voices to people, and I think there are some fabulous examples, including of Australian histories, that do exactly that. So really close to home, Janet McCalman wrote this phenomenal history of the Royal Women's Hospital called Sex and Suffering, in which, she used a combination of patient records but also kind of available biographical details to really bring to life the ways in which women experienced, particularly birth, for example, at the Royal Women's in a time where, the centrality of patient experience was diminished and somewhat ironically male doctors dominated in terms of who your medical service provider was. And I think one of the most compelling chapters in Sex and Suffering includes kind of this insight into what migrant women's experiences in post-World War II Australia was like. If you're an Italian or a Greek woman giving birth, not only were you encountering all of the gender bias against you, you also encountered language barriers, but then also cultural barriers in terms of what you traditionally expected when you gave birth compared to what was the social norm here. And then staying in Australia, another really interesting example of biography was the way in which Rod Holmes used it in his traditional biography of Hans Async, who was a psychologist, a very famous English psychologist, who it turned out had actually basically used fraudulent data. The result of Rod's work, for example, has seen finally, after decades of lobbying, retractions of async's work, which again is a form of correcting the scientific record and is an example of the ways in which biography, when done well, can actually have these really interesting and diverse impacts into how you understand scientific past.
Were there any other good examples that you wanted to talk about?
In history of medicine, at least, for me, at the time that I was going through, one of the kind of most admired works was actually Medical Lives in the Age of Surgical Revolution. It was a type of prosopography, which was a sort of systematic, uniform biography done by Marguerite Dupré and Anne Crowther. And it looked at Lister, who you may know from Listerine, but effectively Lister kind of had this, what we now understand to be this pioneering idea about the role of cleanliness in kind of hospital environments and how that might actually prevent the transmission of disease. And so at the time, it wasn't a necessarily well-received idea, but Lister's students, who kind of went to all parts of British Empire, took this idea and were sort of his apostles, if you will. And so what Medical Lives does is kind of do this prosopography that kind of shows sort of Lister's legacy writ large. And it's a fascinating example of the use of this uniform biographical tool to understand, you know, something that we sort of take for granted today, that you have to keep kind of medical, like operating theatres sterile, or you have to wash your hands, you know. And I feel like perhaps I'm triggering people when I say that post-pandemic. But, you know, these taken for granted ideas weren't necessarily always taken for granted, and someone had to push this through. And so this particular book was, you know, really fascinating use of collective biographical methods to demonstrate the sort of long legacy of Lister.
And in your own research, what were some of the interesting insights that you found? Especially I'm interested in the ones that you didn't expect to come across.
Actually, I think the thing that I didn't expect to come across, and which I think has been probably one of the most insightful things that I ended up making as my own tiny, tiny contribution, was understanding the extent to which migrant doctors shaped the structures of rural and regional medicine, particularly in Australia. Mm. Now, today, we kind of know this because a lot of migrant doctors, in order to not compete with sort of Australian-trained doctors, are sent to regional areas on kind of what's, you know, now referred to as a 10-year moratorium. But in the period that I was researching, there was just this fundamental opposition to even registering these doctors, let alone allowing them to practice, because of the very same kind of underlying notion, which is if we train doctors in Australia, it is Australian-trained doctors who ought to have the first right to practice. But of course, as medical practice became more lucrative and populations in Australia increased, the willingness and the desire to leave urban centres like Melbourne or Sydney and go out to kind of regional areas was diminishing. And what you actually found is that the migrant doctors who somehow managed to get themselves registered, actually this was an available niche, mm-hmm. right? And so what you have are urban communities who are broadly suspicious about immigrants in general, but also immigrant doctors. And then to compare, you've got a lot of country communities who went, actually, this is an opportunity for us to get a really valuable set of skills into our community, right? Having a doctor who was resident meant that you didn't have to drive for 50 minutes on bumpy roads in the middle of winter to get to the closest kind of country town to access primary care or even sometimes specialist care. And so it was that combination of the extent to which sort of migrant doctors found themselves shaping kind of regional, broadly construed, you know, medical structures, but also the ways in which country communities advocated for this. You know, they overcame some of the prejudices because of what it meant, which was access to, you know, a high status kind of service that they really valued.
you found that through these biographies that this was just a common story? Is that how it works?
Precisely, yeah. So I looked at about 500 to 700 doctors in total, and then I did sort of a subset of doctors. So I did every single doctor who held a qualification other than one from Britain or Ireland. And what I consistently found was that they would spend a large proportion of their medical career on arrival and after finally being able to get registered to practice, often in country areas. Mm-hmm. And second to that, often in migrant-dominant suburbs, right? So Footscray and Sunshine and Brunswick, when they were not as hip as they are today, where, again, Australian-trained doctors had the luxury of rejecting them as kind of places they would want to set up practice. And so this sort of repeated pattern that you get out of just literally mapping careers of doctors gives you a sense for actually, if you take a step back and look at it more holistically, what you're actually seeing is that, for example, for a period of 30 years, immigrant doctors effectively filled these gaps. And then you fast forward today, and that's actually the basis upon which access to primary healthcare, for example, in Australia is predicated on, right? The ability to import migrant medical labour to fill gaps where Australian doctors won't. And so if you want, what I did was effectively this prehistory of what we experience in our contemporary medical systems today.
Oh, that's fabulous. Was there anything else you wanted to add in?
That's a very good question, Samara. Only to say this, and I suppose that is, if you are going out into a bookshop and looking for something to pick up, to actually look for interesting biographies. So there are biographies of diseases. For example, you know, one that I was recently looking at, which is a biography of migraine as a concept, which is fascinating. And when you're thinking about figures that are sort of really popular ones, like Darwin, for example, to actually go, well, let's look at what people are saying about it more recently. And in the case of Darwin, what you actually find is that biographies of Darwin are sort of considered actually now more an insight into broader kind of scientific cultures of the time, right? So historians, at the very least, have gone from remembering Darwin as like this genius figure to actually Darwin as a conduit into understanding kind of all of the different contemporary actors who influenced Darwin's work and actually how he's just an icon for a broader kind of scientific moment, if you like. And I think, yeah, that's a really interesting thing to think about.
Oh, absolutely. That's a fabulous place to finish the podcast as well. So I wanted to thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. It's been a delight, Helen.
Amazing. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the first season of the HBS podcast, where we discuss all things history, philosophy, and social studies of science. To learn more, check out our website at hbsunimelb.org. There you can also find links to our blog, Twitter, Facebook, and Insta, as well as show notes for today's topic. I'm Samara Greenwood, and my co-producer is Indigo Keel. We look forward to having you back again next time.